I will call the remote hearing of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. Today is March 31st, 2022. This meeting is held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows for remote hearings. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. The clerk will take attendance by roll.
Chair Hansen is present. Vice Chair Wasilewicz.
Wasilewicz present.
Representative Heintzman. Representative Heintzman. Representative Acomb.
Present.
Representative Ackland.
Ackland present.
Representative Backer.
Backer present.
Representative Becker Finn.
Present.
Representative Ackland.
Present.
Representative Fisher.
Fisher present.
Representative Green.
Present.
Representative Igo.
Igo present.
Representative Jordan.
Present.
Representative Keeler.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lippert.
Lippert present.
Representative Lewick.
Lewick present.
Representative Morrison.
Morrison present.
Representative Nelson.
Nelson present.
Representative Tice. Representative Tice. I saw Representative Heintzman join, correct?
Heintzman present.
Heintzman present. Representative Tice. All right, thank you.
The quorum is present. Representative Igo, would you like to move the minutes for March 29th? Representative Heintzman, would you like to move the minutes for March 29th?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Heintzman moves the minutes for March 29th, 2022. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Ayes have it. Minutes are adopted. Members, today we will be hearing the Governor's Environmental Natural Resources Supplemental Budget Recommendations, and then we are going to move the schedule around a bit. We'll take up the seed treatment bill after that, and then do the policy bill, and hopefully getting done on time. So with that, we will start with the presentation. We've got 1 hour or a half hour for the presentation, and then 20 minutes for questions and answers. And we have the commissioners and staff here. Welcome to the committee. Commissioner Kessler, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, I think you're first, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, this is Katrina Kessler. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Chair Hansen and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, along with other members of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's Commissioner's Office team, as well as our legislative and fiscal teams, to provide an overview of the agency's supplemental budget recommendations. Next slide, please. I think as a starting point, it's always helpful to ground us in the MPCA's mission to protect and improve human health and the environment. Next slide. As you will hear, our supplemental budget recommendations are rooted in three general themes, specifically utilizing the one-time surplus to help local communities address and understand the risks posed by the per- and polyfluoroforever PFAS chemicals. Second, adapt to more extreme weather events. And third, support local communities and businesses in their efforts to foster a healthy environment and vibrant economy. Next slide. Starting with our water proposals. The first proposal recognizes that Minnesota's communities are facing increasing pressure to adapt to extreme weather events and that there are significant gaps in funding available to local governments and tribes to protect community spaces and public infrastructures. Unfortunately, we know today that mega rains are more than two times likely than they were just 30 years ago. For example, in 2014, Duluth saw more than 7 inches of rain in 48 hours, causing more than $100 million in damage to the city's infrastructure. This proposal would provide grants, communities and tribes to design, plan, and implement preparedness projects. These funds would be available for 5 years to match the opportunities presented by the federal infrastructure plans. The second proposal also recognizes that planning and optimization and design work are needed at the local level to get ready to maximize the federal funds coming to the state via the bipartisan infrastructure law to the state revolving fund managed by the Public Facilities Authority. So eligible work for this proposal includes everything from treatment alternatives, looking at ways to minimize and optimize facilities, identifying cost-effective solutions, and exploring innovative permitting approaches. The next two proposals are designed to provide additional resources and data to communities to reduce PFAS. Eligible activities for the community grants include monitoring at wastewater treatment facilities, solid waste facilities, identifying and minimizing upstream sources, or disposing of PFAS containing aqueous firefighting foam from airports. The baseline study would help us determine what normal levels of PFAS are and help focus state and local efforts in areas where there are cause for greater concern in soil and water. The next proposal simply extends the availability of last year's appropriation for the Mercury TMDL on the St. Louis River to provide more time for robust stakeholder engagement with tribes, federal partners, and interested stakeholders. The next proposal is designed to ensure that there's a sustainable funding source for our Smart Salting Training Program. I know the committee has heard about this, and thanks to Representative Fisher and others for carrying a similar bill that has a companion in the Senate that would allow the agency to charge a fee for that training that is currently offered at no charge. The last two proposals are policy only items. One would request would require wastewater treatment operators to notify public and downstream drinking facilities when they have discharges of untreated or partially treated wastewater. Currently, facilities are required to let the duty officer know, but not required to let anyone downstream know. And just for the committee, we've been working with the League of Minnesota Cities and CGMC to improve this proposal since last session. And the second policy proposal item is allowing municipal permit holders to request a waiver of a 30-day pre-public notice review period when wastewater facilities are looking to expand in order to take advantage of a construction window or a better bidding opportunity. Next slide, please. Shifting to the land proposals. The first land proposal calls for investing in Minnesota's solid waste system through one-time grants in four areas, namely prevention of food waste, development of recycling markets, composting and anaerobic digestion development and expansion, and sustainable building materials management. Despite the efforts of many, less than half the waste we create is currently recycled, meaning we're missing out on the environmental benefits as well as the economic opportunities and jobs that are created when we expand recycling and reuse sectors. The second proposal here would help our land programs maintain staff and service levels. This is similar to last year's water and air adjustments. The funding for land program is needed to support current staff. Not being able to maintain current staff would result in individuals and businesses experiencing even longer wait times for tanks, solid waste, hazardous waste permits, and backlogs in addressing contaminated sites. The third proposal on the slide would create a community-based brownfield grant program to assist communities in identifying sites that they think should be redeveloped. The brownfield development is often driven by market forces and economic outcomes, which sometimes leaves properties vacant and community needs unmet. So this would create a program for communities to have a voice at that table. The fourth proposal is related to railroad safety. The MPCA is required under statutory obligations to provide training and response to railroad events. And currently, the funding for that, which was associated with the railroad pipeline safety account, does not exist anymore, expired in 2017. And so we are essentially carrying out that work without the funds. The next proposal, the lead and cadmium in consumer products, expands restrictions on these two toxins that cause negative long-term neurological, reproductive, and developmental impacts. We have specifically called out the use of these products in things like dishes, cosmetics, personal care products, school supplies, where they have been found in other states. The next proposal is a policy item that would increase the capital system program cap. Essentially, this would allow the grant limit of currently $2 million per project per county to be raised to $5 million per project per county. This hasn't been adjusted since 1985, and it would allow for waste prevention and reduction projects to be eligible. This does require a small rulemaking effort. The next proposal was related to solar panel recycling and creates a manufacturer-operated program to reuse, recycle, and properly dispose of discarded solar panels. The stewardship program would meet a need that is currently unmet to deal with discarded solar panels. And as we all know, we are calling for more of these in the future. And based on our experience with e-waste, we don't think we can wait to address this issue. The next proposal is providing uniform tools to brownfields redevelopment. Essentially, we create a revolving fund for the voluntary investigation or VIC cleanup program that is akin to the one that currently exists for the brownfield petroleum brownfield program, and the communities across the state would have better access to more expeditious ability to move through those programs by providing a sustainable funding source. And the last item on this slide is just a policy proposal to reduce the twice a year report related to the 3M settlement funds to 1 year. That this is this would just bring efficiencies to our work. And then we have one item on the next slide. Small businesses are, of course, the economic engines of Minnesota, and this proposal would create a one-time influx of resources to the MPCA Small Business Loan Program to spur economic development and reduce environmental impacts. This program currently funds zero interest loans of up to $75,000 for projects that go beyond regulations to create a reduced waste, create healthier workforce and energy. And we've seen an increase in the interest in this, and this would allow us to expand beyond some of the traditional projects considered. It also contains a policy change that would expand the definition of small businesses to allow more businesses to take advantage of this program. And next slide, that's the last slide that we have, Chair, and I'm happy to turn it over now to DNR Commissioner Stroman, unless there are questions at this point.
Commissioner, I think we will take questions at the end. Thank you. We will next go to Commissioner Stroman. Welcome, and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon to you and to the members of the committee. We're very happy to be here this afternoon to present the governor's budget related to DNR. I do want to note, I'm sorry, I forgot my name, didn't I? Sarah Stroman, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. With me are Bob Meyer, our Assistant Commissioner, and Mary Robinson, our Chief Financial Officer, as well as many other division representatives. So we'll be happy to answer questions after the presentation. Next slide. The governor's recommendations for DNR really fall into three main categories. The recommendations around drought relief, around climate, and around bonding. We know that bonding is dealt with in another committee, and this committee has already dealt with the supplemental drought relief. So we're going to focus on the supplemental budget items related to climate here. I do want to note that across all of these areas, our priorities for budget are really around connecting people with the outdoors, mitigating climate change, proactively managing natural resources, and addressing our operational needs. And those are budget priorities that should be familiar to the committee from last year as well. Next slide, please. So within this proposed budget, there are four main areas that I'm going to walk through, and then there are two additional budget appropriations for DNR that are tied to broader initiatives from the administration. And then there are two items that are part of the governor's revised supplemental budget that I will go over. So the first category of investments is related to climate adaptation for natural lands and waters. We know climate change is already impacting our natural lands and waters, as well as Minnesotans' ability to access and enjoy the benefits those lands and waters provide. The budget includes a $42 million general fund investment to help ensure the continued health of and public access to natural lands and waters in the face of current and future climate change. The funding specifically will address $10 million for improving public water accesses to repair climate change driven flood and ice damage and to reconfigure the sites to ensure they are still functional in the face of future climate change. It includes $10 million for modernizing and adapting fish hatcheries so they are resilient to climate impacts and can support healthy and climate adaptive fisheries. It includes $8 million for upgrading state park roads and trails to withstand more intense rainfall. If they are able, and that's important if we're going to maintain them in a usable state into the future to provide access to our recreation lands. This initiative also includes $1 million for restoring plant communities in state parks to maintain the beauty of these landscapes for current and future visitors to enjoy. And finally, $13 million for replacing culverts and restoring streams to enhance the resiliency of Minnesota fisheries, waterfowl production, wetlands, and lakes to climate change impacts. Next slide, please. The second category of investment relates to restoring grasslands and wetlands on wildlife management areas for carbon capture and resiliency. Grasslands and wetlands will capture and store increased carbon following enhancement or restoration. For grasslands, carbon accumulates in the soil very quickly after enhancement and stays there unless the soils are heavily disturbed. For wetlands, over time, restored wetlands also become a carbon sink. So grassland and wetland enhancement and restoration also advance these climate resiliency goals by increasing water storage and groundwater and aquifer recharge, thereby reducing potential flooding during extreme weather events. Specifically, this proposal includes $10 million of a general fund investment to enhance grasslands and restore wetlands on existing state-owned wildlife management areas to sequester increased carbon and enhance the climate resiliency while also providing better pollinator and other wildlife habitat. Next slide, please. The third investment relates to enhanced forest management assistance to private woodland owners. We know that climate change and forest pests are creating greater need for proactive forest planning and management of private woodlands in addition to public forests. The DNR provides forest management assistance to woodland owners who collectively own 6.8 million acres or 49% of Minnesota's forests. So they are a significant, they have a significant role in this effort. Assisting woodland owners to sustainably manage their forest is key to increasing carbon capture and storage while assuring healthy forests in the face of climate change. This budget proposal includes $5.5 million of general funding to meet the increased demand for planning and assistance and cost share funding to assist private woodland owners whose lands are powerful resources for climate mitigation and adaptation. And I will add that we are working with the Soil and Water Conservation Districts and the Minnesota Forestry Association on this initiative. Next slide, please, Jason. And then the fourth category under the climate investments is acquisition of public lands. These public lands capture and store carbon and provide increased climate resiliency by increasing water storage, thereby reducing flood risk, and they provide habitat for wildlife, pollinators, and other species, which will also help plant and animal communities adapt to future climate conditions. In addition to providing climate and conservation benefits, public lands support outdoor recreation. Time outdoors strengthens family bonds and promotes health and wellness, and access to the these outdoor experiences on public lands has been particularly invaluable for children and families during the COVID-19 pandemic. This budget includes $24 million general fund investment to acquire new public lands to support recreation and conservation with the goal of decreasing the state's net greenhouse gas emissions. Next slide, Jason. Thank you. As I mentioned, there are two other initiatives in the DNR's budget that relate to more broad administration efforts. This relates to expansion of broadband, and so there is $246,000 in this budget for DNR to enhance our capacity for broadband licensing, and there is also $299,000 related to enforcement for the adult use of cannabis legalization. And then, as promised, there are two final items that were part of the governor's revised supplemental budget. The first is $1.73 million to address public safety response that has been continuing with our enforcement division. This is largely around capital presence, capital security, but but without these general funds, as we talked about last session during the biennial budget, Mr. Chair and members, we cannot use game and fish dollars or other dedicated dollars for these general public safety responses. So this appropriation would be important to keep our enforcement division whole and ensure they do not have a deficiency and ensure that our fund integrity. And then lastly, $300,000 for aggregate mapping. This is essentially field research information that helps local governments plan and balance the stewardship of their aggregate resources with environmental concerns and their local economies. I think there's just one more slide, Mr. Chair, that invites any questions from committee members. And I know you intend to take those at the end, so we can move on to the next agency.
Thank you, Commissioner. Next up, John Jashke, Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon. John Jashke, Executive Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and thank you for the opportunity to walk through the provisions in the governor's recommendations. And Jason, thank you for running the slide so you can go right to the next one. I'm all by myself today, Mr. Chairman, a little short on staff, but I'll answer any questions you may have with the committee, and if we don't have the exact answer, I'll make sure I follow up and get a more precise one if needed with other staff. So our agency, of course, works on private lands, and Commissioner Stroman just walked through some of the public lands components and also maybe some private ones too, but ours is exclusively set up to work with local governments on private land conservation. Next slide, Jason. So there are four components that are in the governor's recommendations for Bowser this year, and we have one policy item too, which I don't have on a slide, which has to do with some adjustments that we would like to seek in the dedicated easement management fund that would allow us to preemptively go fix, for example, a water control structure where there's a small problem before it becomes a big one. And that, Mr. Chairman, I think will also be in the bill that you introduced. But back to the budget components then, Mr. Chair and members, the first one is water storage, as has been indicated by Commissioner Kessler and others. You know, we are facing ever-increasing rainfall intensities and sometimes duration as well, which especially on our landscapes that have hydrology that's been altered from what it once was, has created downstream consequences, right? Water quality, infrastructure problems, things like that, that we believe can be well managed by holding water closer to where it lands, right? Holding the water on the land. And so this proposal in some ways is a companion to what Commissioner Kessler described for some of the more urban infrastructure. This would hold water up higher in the headwaters of our watersheds. And this program is currently in law. It's aimed primarily at the Minnesota River and the lower Mississippi River areas where we have the altered hydrology as well as the topography and other considerations that lead to the biggest problems. The next item is a healthy soil program, and this one also, Mr. Chair and members, has a component that's in the Department of Agriculture in their budget area that has to do with equipment grants. This provision here would provide the cost-sharing assistance to landowners, primarily through the soil and water conservation districts, who've got that relationship and the infrastructure to provide that support. The way this would work, of course, is that landowners who are interested in trying, these are all voluntary practices, as is the water storage, something that would improve their soil, but also provide the public benefits of water quality, carbon sequestration, and even in some cases habitat, right? Because those areas become temporary habitat during the fall and spring growing seasons. The focus of this, as I know you've heard from me before, and your committee, I'm sure, also understands, in order to generate the greatest benefit for climate, we want to have durable practices, right? And the focus here would be on those durable practices, things like no-till, things like field borders, things that can provide long-term carbon benefits, as well as those other things that I mentioned that go with it. The next item, Mr. Chair, is a small appropriation for an FTE for the agency to accomplish the tribal government coordination and government-to-government relations that are part of a statutory requirement passed last year. Very important that we do this and do it well and have someone dedicated to that responsibility in our agency. And that can also help in delivering our programs, again, through those local government organizations that do most of the on-the-ground work. And then finally, we have a proposal that would allow us to do a catch-up, basically, for some of the things that did not get done over the last 2 years during COVID. And most of this would be focused on contracts for engineering services to catch up on some of the construction work that had to, you know, unfortunately go by the wayside even during the summer months that when we do most of our work in the past 2 years. So we'd like to make sure we can catch up on that as best we can. Jason, next slide, please. Just a few examples of the situation we're facing with water storage. You can see the graph on the left is the Minnesota River and the change over time in terms of annual daily mean flow. We're getting more water into the system and need to solve that problem by holding it on the land. Next slide. Just an example of this on the Cedar River, some examples of how this works. Again, working with voluntary landowners, but doing it in a way that'll provide public benefits. Next slide, Jason. You've seen these pictures before. Obviously, there's an example of cover crops being put on a cornfield in this case. Next slide. And we know that the University of Minnesota, which has been very key in helping us understand which practices work the best and how to work with landowners to adopt them, is essential to this as well. So we use them as a technical resource to guide all of our programming in this area. Next slide. Pictures of cover crops and soil health practices. Next slide, Jason. I think I covered these two things already. You know what they are, so we'll go to the next slide. I'm probably close to the end. There I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members, for the opportunity to present our recommendations to you.
Thank you. Next up, Sam Paskey, Metropolitan Council Environmental Services. Welcome and state your name for record.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sam Paskey, an Assistant General Manager at the Met Council, and I'm here to share with you our single proposal. We've heard several other worthwhile proposals dealing with infrastructure and climate change already. This project involves a planning effort to help inform how those dollars can best be used within the metro region. You can go to the next slide, please. Extreme weather is impacting our built environment. We see that in many places, but here in the metro for sure. And both infrastructure for cities, counties, and so on in the state, plus private property are impacted. Local governments desire improved tools to prepare for and reduce the risks to water, wastewater, transportation, energy, stormwater conveyance, and government and public safety services. So the Met Council is working with local governments to scope out and build a tool that communities and watersheds, counties, and so on can use to better understand local infrastructure risks from extreme weather and provide better information to private property owners and decision makers, and with that, better target projects and efforts to reduce those risks. Next slide, please. Essentially, we're talking about bringing together data that hasn't been brought together in this way before, and some of the data needs to be improved, and that information will support better decision-making and better information to guide these dollars and efforts that will make a big difference for us as weather continues to change in unexpected ways. That's all I've got for now. If you have questions, I can answer those later. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Laura Bennett McGinty, Explore Minnesota Tourism. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Lauren Bennett McGinty. I am the Executive Director of Explore Minnesota Tourism. And next slide, please. I will be brief. Please note that there is an error. It is not 105 million or 110 million. It is actually just 105,000 and 110,000. But briefly, I just want to touch on the fact that we know and understand there's a lot of work to do to bring tourism in the state back to pre-pandemic levels. And we hope that the proposed funding to support these two full-time employees is a small step that the state can take to help build back our marketing and bring visitors into Minnesota again. The two proposed full-time positions will be used to support our marketing and PR efforts at Explore Minnesota. The goal is to grow our domestic marketing through more diverse publications and the upcoming summer season activities. And we also anticipate that these positions will support the return of international travel and marketing and in PR and markets outside of the state and the country as we open up for international travel. Further, to meet the demands of this competitive industry, we believe that we need a full staff roster so we can continue to support high revenue driving programs like marketing and PR. Supporting at least two full-time employees will help us gain back some of the ground we lost during the pandemic and execute our marketing and PR efforts in a more efficient and effective way. And that is all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Katie Pratt, Environmental Quality Board. Welcome and state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Katie Pratt, Executive Director of the Environmental Quality Board. And next slide, please, Jason. EUB has one recommended item in the Governor's Supplemental Budget, which is for technical assistance and environmental review. Environmental review is an important process for evaluating potential environmental impacts, planning for and mitigating those impacts, and making sound decisions. Over multiple years, EQB has been seeking input on how to make climate assessment consistent, effective, and efficient within Minnesota's environmental review program. The board has been engaging with local governments, businesses, consultants, and members of the public from around the state. And EQB has received clear input that local governments need additional tools for conducting climate assessment within environmental review. Specifically, they would like Minnesota and sector-specific tools and calculators to aid in greenhouse gas calculation. EQB is requesting $600,000, a one-time appropriation, to contract with a technical consultant to develop these tools. Once developed, the climate assessment tools will provide additional accuracy and consistency of public information, while reducing the time, cost, and uncertainty for government units and project proposers during the environmental review process. The tools will also be available for all Minnesota businesses and communities to use for planning to help identify opportunities for climate smart design, development, and innovation. And thank you for your consideration today. I'll stand by for questions.
Thank you. And we will have questions. Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. First question goes with Bowser. On the Healthy Soil Program, is that a new program? What was it funded last year? And maybe I missed it. I'm not familiar with that program. If you could help me with that, I appreciate that.
Director Chashki.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Backer, we have a pilot program in place that was funded previously. That's now about 2 years ago. So the idea here would be to upsize and upscale this, as I noted in the slideshow and actually didn't highlight it. But the adoption rate for soil health practices is growing, but it's still a very low number in terms of the number of acres in Minnesota. So we'd like to accelerate that greatly. And I think it has the potential to be very welcome by landowners, farmers specifically, who have got an interest in trying this and a little bit of help to get going, and primarily doing that with some expertise from a local soil and water conservation district or some of the private sector co-ops that also help with that kind of thing.
Representative Backer.
Thank you. And I appreciate that. I did not recognize that. So it is a more, really a whole new funding mechanism for soil by the sounds of it. I don't know if this is for one of the commissioners or you, Mr. Chair, but this to me is unprecedented, this type of supplement budget. Our taxpayers expect the state to live within their means. The governor last year signed the budget. So obviously, unless we're missing something, he okayed it. The amount of money that is being asked from the taxpayers, which the taxpayers are not Santa Claus, seems they don't have access to it. So I'm really quite challenged on these amounts, new programs, these enhancements. Yeah, I know everybody can justify why they need more money, but at the end of the day, middle-class people and our families need more money, and we keep pulling the money out of their pocket. I'm just really concerned about a precedence. This is a bonding year, and this now seems like a budget year. So, and we did our work last year. The governor signed the budget, so I don't know who wants comment on it. Obviously, the commissioners will disagree with my comment. You will too, Chair, but we have to fight for the taxpayer's wallet. That's my comment.
Thank you, Representative Backer. We're paid for 2 years. We work for 2 years. We have needs in front of us. So we've had testimony for the past 2 months on needs, and the governor's budget is responding to those needs. They're here today. We have had other priorities in front of this committee as well. So, you know, as the Biden economy continues to roar, there's money that comes into state coffers as well, there's an opportunity there to solve some of these longstanding challenges and problems. Mr. Jashke could respond on that.
Yeah, but we really quick on what the chair said, you know, and this is the commissioners. To what I can tell, these are wants and not needs. And with you talk about the roaring economy, it is roaring. The inflation is roaring up, and our people out in West Central Minnesota is not getting extra money. So, I mean, I appreciate your comment, Chair. I really do. But I'm concerned that these are wants and not needs.
Maybe Mr. Jashke could just respond to kind of demand that's out there.
Mr. Chairman, specifically to the soil health program and the pilot, we had money to fund a small effort in five counties. We had 18 that had asked for that, and we've got many, many more now that are interested in doing it. So there's certainly demand out there, and we'd like to be helpful in that, in filling that demand. I should also mention we can also use these dollars to leverage federal funding as well in both cases, right? Because there's USDA funding that would help us add to these dollars in Minnesota and make our dollars go further.
Commissioner Stroman, was it to this point or is it to something else?
It was to this point, Mr. Chair. If I might just add one thing from the department's perspective, and again, Sarah Stroman, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Representative Backer, to your question, we understand, you know, the value that taxpayers put on their dollars. We also understand the value that taxpayers put on our natural resources and our outdoor experiences in Minnesota. And all of the investments that the governor has proposed for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, with the exception of the broadband, which has some ongoing staff, are one-time investments. And they are needs. They are things that the department has been asking for a number of years, such as money and bonding bills to fix hatcheries or watercraft fee increases to address our public water access needs. We haven't received all of those dollars that we need. And so given the state's financial situation, given that we have general funds surplus on hand, we believe that it is really important to invest in those things that we know Minnesotans care about, that we know Minnesotans are using. And that, frankly, we aren't able to, without some investment that we haven't seen in quite some time, continue to provide the quality of services that we have. So, you know, and we'd be happy to chat with you more offline, but these really are one-time investments above and beyond the supplemental budget. Or, I'm sorry, beyond the regular biennial budget.
Representative Wasilek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to thank the agencies for putting this presentation together. My constituents are telling me they actually want us to spend some of the surplus on these things, on PFAS prevention and monitoring, on making sure that our state parks and state lands are ready for climate change and other climate change pieces as well. So I think now is the time. I think there are several urgent things that are happening, climate change being one big one that I think is something that we need to address. And if we have funding to do that, that's something that addressing climate change is good for everyone. It's good for everyone in the state and across the country. If we can do things to fight back against climate change and adapt, that's good for all of our communities. Just had a couple questions for PCA. I'm glad to see some PFAS items in your budget. As you know, I'm I hate PFAS and I want to do everything we can to get rid of it. But I'm just wondering if you can provide maybe Commissioner Kessler or someone else from Team PCA can provide a little bit more information about the baseline piece, so that the testing piece, like what would that look like for the different mediums? And then my other question was, what are some, you know, potential examples or things you might see being done with those community grants?
Commissioner Kessler.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Walzik, for the question. I think we share your sentiment about PFAS. And for the baseline study specifically, this is a one-time investment to really bring up our level of understanding in water and soil around the state so that we can then pair that to the facility work that's happening regarding monitoring and looking for sources, and then where we might need to have treatment. And it really pairs up where we think we have sources and where we think we have problems, so that it makes us better situated, again, to take advantage of federal funds that would be available for wastewater treatment or for other infrastructure upgrades. Because at this point, I don't think we have a good understanding of all of the PFAS challenges around the state. We unfortunately have an understanding of some of them, but not all of them. And the baseline study complemented that with the work that needs to happen at the facilities will help us build that level of understanding so we can really maximize both state and federal investments. And so then on the grants, excuse me, we recently, as part of our PFAS blueprint, rolled out a PFAS monitoring plan that is asking 400 permitted entities across the state to look at what sources they may have coming to their conduits or to their facilities. And these dollars could be used to offset some of those costs at public facilities to do the monitoring. It also, if you know that you have a source because of monitoring, can help pay for consultants or technical advice to figure out where that source might be coming from or how to minimize or replace that source. So it's really, again, trying to minimize things coming into facilities that ultimately don't end up in the air, water, or soil, so that if we can't minimize, we then can couple those sources where we know we have to have treatment with the ambient understanding that the baseline study gets us to really focus going forward where we should do additional work.
Representative Ackland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Commissioner Stroman. Commissioner, would you just expand a little bit on the $299,000 request for legalizing adult use cannabis?
Commissioner Stroman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Ackland. And I will call on Assistant Commissioner Bob Meyer to help me with this, but essentially, because we have enforcement personnel or conservation officers at the Department of Natural Resources, there are anticipated costs that would be related to enforcement of that would fall to our enforcement division, is my understanding. But I would defer to Mr. Meyer if he has additional details.
Mr. Meyer, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for the record. Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner DNR. And Representative, thank you for that question. Commissioner Stroman was correct in her response. These would cover our costs for training and enforcement should that law go into place. There's other agencies receiving that I have similar appropriations within the governor's budget that reflect their work on this issue as well. So thank you.
Representative Ackland.
Thank you.
Representative Heinzman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a number of questions for each of those that presented today, but I am going to start by just checking in. It's that time of year to start talking about targets. And, you know, just today we've heard it was cumulatively, I think, approaching hundreds of millions of dollars. And I'd be real curious to know what your caucus is looking at in terms of targets and get some feedback on that over the course of the last 2 months. We've obviously heard a huge number of bills that are spending, again, hundreds of millions of dollars. And yeah, any feedback you might have on that would be appreciated, Mr. Chair.
Representative Heinzman, I believe the targets are going to be rolled out next week as the bills are posted. I think some bills are getting posted maybe even tomorrow, the omnibus DEs. So I anticipate as that is happening, we're looking at building the bills. You know, we've been listening to the testimony, including testimony today. Happy to work with you on shared priorities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure that we got an answer there. We're all waiting to hear what the numbers are going to be, especially when we're hearing such significant requests from the agencies. And I have to echo Representative Backer's comments in that I know that some would like to tout the surplus as something that that President Biden is responsible for, and of course we all know that that is not there because of anything President Biden did necessarily. That is there because of trillions of dollars in federal spending. It got dumped into the economy, and we're seeing the result of that. So, you know, there's a number of things that agencies brought up today in their presentations, and I'll just start with Commissioner Stroman at MPCA. I see an $11 million budget increase for operating, and I think that goes into 2025. So a huge amount of money being increased in spending there for operating, when we have, in fact, as was pointed out earlier, just passed a budget for MPCA last year, and now in the supplemental, we're asking for quite an increase. Does Commissioner Stroman know the increase over base that an $11 million price tag would be if this were to move forward and become law?
Commissioner Stroman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heintzman, it sounds like you're talking about a request from the PCA, which would go to Commissioner Kessler.
Mr. Chair, I have names mixed up. I apologize, Commissioner, and I will get that right, Commissioner Stroman. So if you Kessler, that would be very helpful, and I apologize for the mix-up. Just looking at my notes and jotted down a lot of things here, as we've had, I think, five or four presentations from agencies. So if Commissioner Kessler's answer to that question, that'd be great.
It's okay, Representative Heintzman. I was a little rattled when I thought you were becoming a Keynesian there for a moment. So Commissioner Kessler.
Thanks, Chair Hansen and Representative Heintzman, for the question. I'm not sure that I have the exact answer for you, but we will provide it. I will say that this is the result of us looking at the costs that are associated with increases in salary. And given the opportunity that presents itself with the supplemental budget, recognizing that we want to be able to continue to pay the staff we have to permit and provide technical assistance in the land programs, we are taking advantage of this one-time opportunity. But we will follow up with the exact increase over the base.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Kessler. I would have hoped that would have been taken into account when the budget presentations came forward last year. So I guess I'm not totally clear on how that is now suddenly appearing on the radar, but I'll move on. Maybe some folks, I think it was Sam from Metropolitan Council, was going through a mapping infrastructure, climate risk, and resiliency opportunity. So if Sam could explain, because, you know, we've gone through this before, and you know, years ago, the big buzzword in this subject area was global warming. Now we're calling it climate change. And when these things come up, you know, I'm always trying to understand, you know, we're talking about taxpayer dollars, and, you know, in the private sector, we're commonly discussing a cost-benefit analysis. And I'm wondering how the Metropolitan Council is going to be able to determine in some kind of cost-benefit analysis whether or not taxpayer dollars were spent wisely, and how are we going to determine, is there a mathematical formula? What is it that the Met Council is going to do to confirm that that this investment, quote-unquote, actually accomplished anything? And I'm sincerely asking because I'm frustrated trying to understand. And many of the presenters today had similar bills or requests. So we'll just start there, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Paskey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Heintzman, for the chance to clarify. We're working with the communities, the cities, counties, and so on within the region. The Met Council, in this capacity, is a planning agency. So we're looking forward and our stakeholders, the steering committee, if you will, composed of local government, has asked for a forward-looking tool to help them make decisions about where to put money in the future. One of the comments even this week from our steering committee was that when flooding happens, half of those costs happen outside of a FEMA floodplain where flood insurance is not required. That puts an inordinate burden on property owners that they may not be aware of, and also local government with infrastructure in those areas. Our proposal is to bring together the information to make better decisions about where to target those limited dollars so that issues like sewer backups or degraded green infrastructure, which we're trying to invest more in, or drinking water scarcity, building flooding, flash flooding, rising groundwater soil saturation, which can reduce the tree canopy that we invest in at a municipal level. All these bad things can happen. If we have the right information ahead of time, we can target those dollars to make a difference, not only for what we plan to do, but also when there are emergencies, we can have planned how to help people, get people out of those areas in advance. Thank you for that chance to clarify.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heinzman.
Yeah, thank you. With all due respect, there is actually no answer to my question. We're trying to figure out how, if we're going to measure success as we present proposal after proposal, cumulatively hundreds of millions of dollars, taxpayer dollars being spent, how do we measure success as it relates to quote unquote climate change? If global warming was the buzzword years ago, now it's climate change. There's got to be some kind of a measurement that we could apply to how these dollars are being spent and determine whether or not our investment, taxpayer dollars in this case, is actually paying off. And Commissioner Stroman had a presentation a little bit ago that talked about purchasing, I believe, at least $11 million or more in public lands, specifically related to greenhouse gas emissions. And in your presentation, you also had this request. You know, each of the agencies is bringing up something related to climate change. And I'm hoping that maybe you could help me understand. And if you can't, maybe somebody else could. What the exact cost-benefit analysis would look like and how we would determine whether or not the investment, the taxpayer investment in that category was actually cumulatively having the effect that we want.
I think, Representative Heinzman, I'm going to give all of the commissioners an opportunity to answer that because you seem to be addressing all of them. So we'll go with Commissioner Stroman, then Commissioner Kessler, and then Director Jashke, and then on down the line. So I think
Mr. Chair, I would just ask that if we were to open it up to all of the commissioners, that they would address my specific question rather than discussing other subcategories of the discussion.
I think they heard you. Commissioner Stroman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Heinzman. And I will address specifically the example you brought up of land acquisition, too. And we are working on methodologies to specifically measure the amount of carbon that is captured when we put when we acquire and protect a parcel of land and that is managed for grasslands or managed for forests or some other kinds of use. And so we can, because there are there is research that tells us how much carbon a grassland or a forest or a tree will sequester. So one of the things that we are actually looking to do is to be able to monitor that over time, be able to use those kinds of measurements to understand, are we getting the biggest bang for the buck in our management decisions? If we, enhance a grassland with more species and greater diversity, will that up the carbon storage benefit? And that's in addition to the other multiple benefits, of course, that we want to get out of public land. So the water quality benefits, as I mentioned, the wildlife habitat values, and the benefit of public access and recreation.
Commissioner Kessler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Heinzman, to your question specifically about costs, I believe the Minnesota Insurance Federation uses the ratio of $1 invested in adaptation and resilience avoids $6 in costs later when you have flood and a need to respond to emergency weather situations. So these dollars will essentially be costs avoided later on when we don't have to pay as much in emergency response.
Director Jaskey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinzman, I'll go to the soil health example. Certainly, you know, there are measures, and farmers actually do this and they pay for it themselves, which is, you know, soil testing. And the primary criteria for carbon sequestration, of course, is soil organic matter, right? And soil organic matter is a really important thing for productivity as well, right? Because if you have healthy soil, you can grow more crops and grow them to a greater yield, and typically with less inputs, which means better profits too. It's just getting people to try this and experience it and get it setting up for themselves on their land with their soil types and their cropping system. That's what this investment would be for.
Mr. Chair, just a comment if I could.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I hope that the public is tuning in to hearings like this, and sometimes it's a little bit difficult to drill down and get hard answers to the questions that are coming to us as legislators. And as we're presenting them to decision makers here today, I hope the public notices that we're not getting any kind of a definition of if the temperature goes up or if the temperature goes down or if rain events decline to this level or increase to this level, that we're going to be able to determine whether or not the taxpayer dollars were spent in a way that we can actually count as a win or a loss, or if we need to spend more, if we need to spend less. There's a lot of different answers across the board. And in my mind, it should be very, very, very duplicatable. And there should be some kind of a scientific process that we can look at what's happening in the environment and say, okay, our investment paid off. And this is the climate change that we were seeking. And that appear, there is no apparent definition. And that's really frustrating because here we are, we're asking for a supplemental budget in the hundreds of millions of dollars cumulatively between the agencies. And not one of them can give me a definition as to what is a win or what is a loss even. There may be a calculation that can be made in terms of what we believe is adjusted in terms of a specific category that we're looking at, like carbon. But as it relates to actual changes in the environment, there doesn't appear to be any formula that we can use to measure whether or not our investment paid off. That's what I'm frustrated about in these. And maybe that's something that's an unrealistic, but it at least has to be, I think, discussed. And you know, I could say a lot more about that, Mr. Chair, but I can see that you're looking forward to maybe coming to the end of this discussion, so I'll go ahead and leave it.
Well, I was actually looking on the bright side that at least you're discussing how to measure rather than whether or not climate change is occurring. So I was looking for the bright side there.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, and I think that we're all right there with you trying to figure out, well, what is the definition and how can we find a win together, Republicans and Democrats. And I think there's no disagreement, at least that I'm aware of, that the climate does change. So we agree.
I see Representative Lewick is lined up behind you, Representative Heinzman. So maybe if we can jump to him, and I want to make sure we get everybody in who has a question before we move to the next items, which we only have limited amount of time. So Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a real quick one. I'm curious on the $299,000 intended to train, I guess, conservation officers on how to deal with adult use of marijuana. Can you be more specific, or do I understand what it is the agency's doing? Is you're going to be training conservation officers in preparation for legalizing adult use of marijuana? That's what I thought I heard.
Commissioner Stroman, you want that one, or Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, I can answer that question.
Mr. Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner DNR. Representative Lewick, this was put in the governor's budget as it was being developed over the course of the process, which starts in the last quarter of last year. in anticipation of what I thought we were thinking was going to be a bill passed that would legalize the use of marijuana. And this would enable us the skills to provide the skills and training necessary to be part of that enforcement. There are other pieces within the governor's supplemental budget that would fund other agencies for these types of activities as well. Should that law not go into place, these funds would not be needed.
No, thank you. That's interesting. I think maybe more appropriate look would be to continue to help our conservation officers work on drug abuse and issues that they do happen onto in the fish houses and in the boats and in the hunting shacks. So I'm just kind of disappointed that you would even put this forward. I would hope in the future that we move the cart into the right position with the horse. We do need to make fundamental decisions before we start training people in anticipation of what we think we might do. So anyway, but thank you. I appreciate that.
Members, we've spent an hour on this. I want to thank the agencies for their presentation. We do have a couple items of business we do need to do. I do want to note that we did have an error on the minutes, and so we're going to have to do a do-over tomorrow on the minutes. So not a big deal, but we'll just bring it up again. And I'm going to hand the gavel over to Vice Chair Wasilewicz so we can do House File 766.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. As the chair noted, we are doing House File 766, first of the bills today. Rep. Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 766 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Rep. Hansen, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee and folks watching at home. House File 766 is another attempt. We had this bill last year, and in the intervening year, we have made some changes to this in the Ag Committee. This bill deals with when does a seed that is treated no longer be considered a seed, but be considered waste? And the importance for this is that we've had issues with waste, particularly with waste seed going to a site in Nebraska. And we have a testifier from Nebraska who actually did her some of her graduate work at the University of Minnesota, who's going to testify a bit about what's happening there. In addition, what this bill does is it provides clarity on what are not disposal methods for treated seed. So it's clear. It also provides for rulemaking for the PCA, because the PCA is responsible for disposal. There is a provision in here that provides for information and education materials. That is with the Department of Agriculture, and they will be carrying that in their bill as they prepare their bill. With that, I would move to our testifiers.
All right. First on the list today is Judy Wu Smart. If you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Judy Wu Smart. I'm an assistant professor and bee specialist at the University of Nebraska Lincoln. I want to first thank Representative Rick Hansen and the committee for this opportunity. I'm acting today on my own capacity and not as a representative of the university. I testified last year regarding bee losses that we were experiencing due to systemic pesticide pollution caused by a facility that was processing pesticide-treated seeds as a method of ethanol production. And it was producing a lot of solid and liquid waste, highly contaminated with pesticide residues. 1 year later, there remains no regulatory division at EPA to respond to the pollinator losses and concerns related to systemic pesticide pollution, or when toxins move into the plants, like in these blooming wildflowers. And the federal loophole that allows treated articles, such as pesticide-treated seeds, to become exempt for pesticide regulation is still in place. I understand that having a piecemeal approach and different state regulations can complicate matters for businesses, but there are common sense improvements that could be easily adopted and is frankly necessary because of the federal exemptions. For example, we need clear language regarding at what point and when in the life of the treated seed does it become classified as hazardous waste. This has been the root of the problems in Nebraska because the company argued for years that they were not producing a waste but economically valuable byproducts, which were sold and distributed to farmers without their knowledge of the contaminants. A simple expiration date based on seed viability and product effectiveness would help clarify this. Also, there already exist regulations on solid waste, air, soil, and water pollution, but the residues of systemic pesticides can move across matrices from waste into water, into soil, and into plants. Are regulatory agencies prepared and supported to monitor this non-target movement of the residues? Not unless they're able to determine the amount and types of chemicals initially introduced into a system and intentionally introduced. Only then can agencies determine where unintended movement and risk of exposure has occurred. I'd like to end by noting that one benefit of having individual state responses to this concern is that there's an opportunity here. We can evaluate these compounds where they are beneficial and in which scenarios they're not. Eliminating uses where there's little or no value allows us to better conserve and protect these products for the systems that truly do rely on them. Chemical overloading and the lack of knowledge regarding use, movement, spread, persistence, and toxicity of these systemic pesticides are real concerns with One Health consequences. And this bill begins to address those knowledge gaps. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Wusmart, for your testimony and the important work you do, and your profile picture for Zoom is pretty cool. Next up on the agenda for testifiers is Sarah Hoyle. If you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Great, thank you. I'm Sarah Hoyle with the Xerxes Society for Invertebrate Conservation, and Hoyle is H-O-Y-L-E, here today to support House File 766. As a group that works directly with farmers across Minnesota, we're well-versed in the importance of balancing pest management and wildlife conservation. North America's wild pollinators are facing precipitous declines. Roughly 17% of butterflies and 28% of bumblebee species are now at risk of extinction. Pollinator declines like these are linked to habitat loss, pesticide use, and diseases. House File 766 takes a small step to address the risks that certain pesticides can pose to pollinators and communities across Minnesota. Neonicotinoid insecticides, or neonics, are a priority concern for pollinators because they are long-lived, highly toxic, and systemic. They're also very prevalent in the landscape since they are applied to the vast majority of corn and soybean seed planted. Despite treated seeds' widespread use, it is exempted from federal pesticide regulations once it is applied to the seed through a loophole. There are numerous exposure pathways for pollinators from treated seed, now including their quote-unquote disposal in ethanol plants. In response to the severe pesticide contamination at an ethanol plant in Mead, Nebraska that processed treated seed that Dr. Wusmart just outlined, House File 766 prohibits the use of neonic treated seed in ethanol production. Neonics can harm invertebrates at levels as low as one part per billion, but were found in the plant's contaminated wastewater and distiller's grain at up to 554,000 parts per billion. Neonics have now also been found up to 4 miles away from the Nebraska plant at toxic levels in waterways, and the cleanup of the plant is continuing to pose a challenge for state regulators and the local community. Because treated seed is exempted from federal pesticide regulations once the seed is treated, a similar situation could arise in Minnesota if this activity is not expressly prohibited. House File 766 does just that. In the year since the situation in Nebraska came to light, the seed industry has still not been transparent about their plans for disposal of excess treated seed. While we know that it is no longer going to the facility in Mead, we don't know where it is going or how it is being handled. There are no assurances that ethanol plants in Minnesota or in other states are not accepting or could not accept treated seed. In fact, industry guides and including testimony that was submitted to this committee today still include ethanol processing as a recommended means of disposal for treated seed. House File 766 would help ensure that excess treated seed is handled appropriately by directing MDA and MPCA to create guidance and regulations about its handling. The proposed rulemaking for disposal would clarify how excess treated seed can be handled in the state and which state agencies are responsible should a problem arise. Currently, there are no true restrictions on how treated seed can be disposed of, and the potential impacts of other disposal methods beyond ethanol remain unknown. Given the challenges associated with handling this pesticide-laden waste, MPCA should provide rulemaking to address how this material should be handled appropriately. Unfortunately, the impacts of neonic-treated seed can extend far beyond its use in fields. House File 766 is a small but critical step forward to reduce the risk that treated seed can pose to pollinators and communities across Minnesota, and we urge the committee to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Now we will open it up for member questions. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question would be for MPCA Katrina Kessler, if she could address what I am seeing in line 2.26, the Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency in consultation with the Commissioner of Agriculture and the University of Minnesota must adopt rules under Minnesota statutes, and then it goes on. I'd like to know, Commissioner, do you foresee or envision what the rules might look like? It looks to me like this gives you broad authority to work through that process. What do you expect to see, Commissioner?
Commissioner Kessler.
Chair Wasilek and Representative Hansen, I'm going to actually ask Division Director Dave Benke to answer this question. He's been our contact coordinating with the Department of Agriculture on this topic.
Mr. Benke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Dave Benke, Director of the Resource Management Assistance Division at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Based on the bill that we are looking at, the rulemaking would take a look at the disposal methods that we currently have in place in the state and identify those that are appropriate for a disposal of the seed. Those that are not allowed under the regulations would not be able to use those seeds as a feedstock or for disposal. So we've already begun that process with the Department of Agriculture and provided some guidance to the seed manufacturers in the state on how they can go about disposing the seeds with the facilities that we have in place. This is a product that still will require some level of disposal if it's not used as originally intended. And so that's what we've looked at. And that's what the rulemaking would develop.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heintzman.
Madam Chair, excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Benke, I'm trying to maybe drill down a little too closely what those rules might look like. I understand the category or the subject area where the rules would be made, but I was trying to get a flavor for what those rules might actually look like. If we don't know, that's okay, but it was just something considering that, you know, we do have some broad authority being given to MPCA to determine what those rules are. It'd been nice to know. I'm not sure maybe if those conversations haven't happened yet in consultation with Bill Author, but maybe I would just ask the bill author if the bill author could foresee any specific rules or what we might be looking at. And if you don't, that's okay. We can move on to another question.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Heintzman. Well, I think the lines 2.26, 2.7, 2.8 are kind of describe that the PCA in consultation with the Commissioner of Agriculture and the University of Minnesota. So you have the best available science provided in rulemaking. Rulemaking does. I know that for some rulemaking is kind of a negative concept, but actually it encourages involvement and it provides for a process actually longer and stronger than we are here today to get input both from the regulated clientele, but also from the scientists who've been doing the research, like Dr. Wu Smart. Who can provide input into that process. And it still has to go through an administrative law judge and a process and hearings. So to say what the rules will be when we're just authorizing the rules is when we are just authorizing the rules now is premature. And I would encourage the interests as well as the public, should this become law, to be engaged in that. The issue is right now, as the testifiers have mentioned and has been mentioned before, is that there is ambiguity in when does something go from being a used product to being a waste? And is that waste solid waste or is it hazardous waste? And how do we make sure that Minnesotans know how to properly handle that?
And I think it's a good step. The items in section 4 are explicit in how not to dispose of it. That means not burying treated seed by a drinking water source. I think we could all agree on that. And not disposing of treated seed by incinerating within a home or another dwelling. I'd hope we can agree on that.
Representative Heintzman?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hansen, I guess being as this was the second time this bill has come through the process, I guess I had mistakenly assumed that there was a little bit more specifics that could be offered as to what the rules might look like. I mean, for all we know, we could be storing or disposing of seeds in some kind of a permanent fashion. I don't know. I'm just trying to figure out what it might actually look like. And it's clear none of us actually do know that this is going to be something that would potentially be worked out later. We can all ask a lot of questions, but it doesn't sound like there's any answers. I do have a question. You brought it up, Representative Hansen. Where did the incinerating within a home or dwelling come from? Is there something that was transpiring, you know, across the state where people were using this for fuel?
Those Madam Chair, and the items, Representative Heintzman, in Section 4, those are guidance that was prepared by the University of Minnesota. So that is guidance that they are encouraging. It's not required now. So I believe if you have to have encouragement on that, not to do that. As you know, there are corn burners that are out there that are sold that people could have in their shop or in their home or in their I guess it's called a chouse or a farm dough now. You know, there's a lot of unique ways where people are heating buildings. So that where that came from is directly from educational material from the University of Minnesota. I think you could find it online if you searched.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's all the questions I have for now. We'll talk, I guess, more if this bill shows up at a later date. Thank you.
Other member questions? Give it a second here. Not seeing any hands go up. Representative Hansen, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would note Commissioner Peterson has been working on this as well. So there has been work done with the PCA and the Department of Ag. I think Mr. Benke referenced that. So we have made progress in working on this and hope that we will continue to. I would ask for your support. I would renew my motion that House File 766 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 766 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Next on the agenda is House File 4407. Representative Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I will move that House File 4407 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
And Representative Hansen, I believe you have the A1 author's amendment. Would you like to move that amendment and explain it for us briefly?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will move the A1 amendment. This is a technical amendment suggested by Ms. Taylor.
All right, Representative Hansen moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is the DNR policy and technical bill. I have Jason Garms from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources to present the agency's bill.
Mr. Garms, if you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, I'm Jason Garms, Minnesota DNR in our government relations unit. And before us, House File 4407 is what we refer to as our DNR policy and technical bill. This is a suite of policy-related and technical changes to multiple programs that we administer in the DNR. So it's modernizing some older definitions, simplifying or clarifying various procedures, or even increasing recreational opportunities where we see that. So if it pleases the committee, I could go through and very briefly touch on each of those items in the interest of time and then see where the questions fall.
Yeah, Mr. Garms, if you can proceed with just brief presentations on the items and then we'll move to questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, I'll kind of start from the top, if you will, starting in section one, permitting efficiency and deadlines. This is changing the deadline for the permitting efficiency report from August 1st to October 1st. This just allows us to a little more time to put together a good report and gather the information needed for that. Moving to the next is snowmobile registration and display. This is found in sections, it's kind of spread out, 2, 3, 4, 5, 18, 19, and 20. This is related to providing for easier verification of registration on snowmobiles. It moves to a larger detail on the location and another number of items related to that. Again, it is for just for easier verification of the snowmobile registration. Next is the Greenleaf State Trail Recreational Area. This is adding the Greenleaf Lake State Trail connection to the Loose Line State Trail, just extending recreational opportunities connecting the city of Hutchinson to the Greenleaf State Recreational Area. Moving right along, the next piece related to the State Park Reservation System found in Section 7. This is standardizing our reservation practices across a variety of services. So this would add day use facilities, tours, educational programs, seminars, events, rentals, and those things in allowing the commissioner to set reservation policies for those, just like we do now for campsites and lodging. It just provides us standardization across all of those different reservation options. Next is the timber permit postmark deadline. This is simply changing the requirement for submitting the timber permit invoice from paid within 30 days to postmarked within 30 days. And that's just to accommodate possibly slow mail delivery and to no fault of that permit holder. The next two are related to deer hunting. The first one found in section 9 and 13. This has to do with definitions around muzzleloader and use of muzzleloader. This is an update to accommodate a newer, different style muzzleloader and clarifying that that style of muzzleloader could legally be used to harvest or hunt deer in Minnesota. The next is also related to deer hunting, section 14 and 20. This eliminates the current shotgun zone. This allows the use of all legal firearms to use statewide during the regular firearm season. Next is expanding uses on walk-in access areas. This would add bird watching, photography, and similar compatible uses to the purposes and eligible uses of walk-in access areas. Right now, it would just say hunting. This adds those additional uses to those areas. Moving to the next, these are related to wildlife management area accessibility. First, this is in section 11. This is changing the way we describe the use of motorized vehicles, changes the language from disabled hunters and changes that to people with disabilities. As we know, many of those people with disabilities who use wildlife management areas are not just there to hunt, so it accommodates that. And then some rulemaking that's associated with that too. The next piece related to tribal IDs, this is related to providing proof for the purchase of a resident hunting, fishing, or trapping license. This just clarifies that a tribal identification card is a valid and acceptable proof of residency, much like we might use a state driver's license, just clarifying that piece. Next is the ground blind blaze requirements. So in addition to the blaze clothing requirements, this adds a requirement that a person in a ground blind on public land must have the blaze orange or pink covering on the top of the blind. This is just a safety provision. Next, the non-lethal hazing of deer and elk. So this would change would allow property owners to non-lethally scare or haze deer and elk causing damage on agricultural crops. And there are other provisions within there that I won't get into that obviously would prohibit doing things that would exhaust or harm the animals in trying to do that. The next is two-line river fishing. This would allow two-line fishing on the Minnesota River downstream of the Granite Falls Dam and the Mississippi River downstream of the St. Anthony Falls. It's just recognizing that those are unique fisheries and trying to increase the angling opportunities in those two fisheries and situations. So that's my extremely fast run through, and I would stand for questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Garms. We do have Craig Engwall here from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association if there are questions that he might be able to answer. And with that, I will turn it over to folks. If members have questions, feel free to raise your hand. I'm not seeing any hands go up. Representative Hansen, did you have any closing remarks?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would lay the bill over for possible inclusion.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 4407 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Chair Hansen, did you have anything you wanted to share before we adjourn here? Any updates or anything to share with the committee members?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And tomorrow, members, we have a full agenda. There were a couple of bills that were added later and have a later amendment deadline. Mr. Strohmeyer, I think, could you just describe those? And then one of those bills had an XXX House file, I believe. It will be getting a number today if it hasn't already. If Mr. Strohmeyer wants to provide some details.
Mr. Strohmeyer.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. We added a couple bills later. One is a XXS, but the reviser language was posted on the committee website and sent out to members. And then we will take up from the table the lands bill, and that is taking up from the table that included the A2 amendment that was adopted in committee. There is an amendment being drafted on that will be posted at the deadline. So since we added those later, we had a different deadline for those two bills specifically for 5:30 tonight. And a House file on the XX will be assigned. I think if you're assigned to the order of business, you've see that the bill introduction email has already gone out, but we will add that once the bill introductions are formally acted upon at session. So the 5:30 deadline, and then the public testimony is still up to an hour before the hearing. The members of the public can sign up to testify up to an hour before the hearing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Anything else, Representative Hansen?
We have a busy week ahead.
All right. Thanks, everyone. With that, we are adjourned.